You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are a whole lot of high-tech entertainment options out there in the world, but some people are turning to low technology like Dungeons & Dragons. We find out why.
First, the Great Lakes ecosystem could be under threat from invasive Asian carp. Lawmakers and conservationists have been working for years to prevent their spread into Lake Michigan.
But some work on the issue has stalled. Reports needed from the Army Corps of Engineers haven't been conducted or finished. And if the Asian carp make it into the Great Lakes system, there could be some serious ecological and economic damage.
Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin is with us now to talk about moves she and some of her colleagues are making to raise awareness of the issue, namely getting the Brandon Rhodes study finalized. Senator Baldwin, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to join you.
Something you've been looking at this year and, you know, throughout your tenure has been invasive species mitigation, certainly in the Great Lakes. And there's been this study called the Brandon Rhodes study that's been in the works for a little while. Can you break that down for us really quickly?
Absolutely. And it's actually been in the works for a long, long time. So Brandon Rhodes refers to a place which is really a choke point in the Chicago waterway system that could prove to be our best hope for preventing the invasive species, the Asian carp, from getting into the Great Lakes. And it's viewed, the Chicago waterway system is viewed as probably the greatest vulnerability in terms of these invasive species heading toward and ultimately possibly getting into the Great Lakes. And it would be devastating if they did for the ecosystem. So for a long, long time, they've been looking at what additional measures could be installed in that Brandon Rhodes lock and dam area to prevent the Asian carp from getting into Lake Michigan. And it's been enormously frustrating because each step in this process has taken a long time and been delayed. And at the very beginning of this administration, there was further delay after a hard deadline for the Brandon Rhodes report to be issued. And now we're facing frustrations that even if their recommendations were implemented, they're looking at years and years before that would happen.
These invasive species are not going to be waiting for any sort of legislation to go through. It seems to be a bipartisan issue. So what exactly is the holdup, it sounds like?
Yeah, so I think all the Great Lakes senators feel very strongly about this and understand the enormous economic and ecosystem impacts this would have if Asian carp were to get into the Great Lakes system. So we have joined together in very bipartisan fashion. There's a number of obstacles that we're dealing with. Early on, it was that the Army Corps of Engineers was basically saying, we don't know how to stop them. And so we're still doing basic research. And by the way, a lot of that research happens in Wisconsin at in La Crosse at the U.S. Geological Survey Upper Midwest Environmental Services Center, which is really exciting science. But going from the laboratory to putting it out in the field is taking a long time. So that's one impediment that is very real. But I think then beyond that, this requires Congress to focus adequate resources to move this ahead. And we have to look at why it's taking so long. Part of it is they need a local sponsor to pitch in dollars. But that's something that we could help them cut through. And so there's too much foot dragging. And again, I think it doesn't recognize the really critical harm that this particular invasive species, the Asian carp, would do to our Great Lakes system.
And, you know, you were a signatory on a letter to the Army Corps of Engineers. Do they want to get this started, or is it maybe less of a priority for them right now?
Well, I think that they're resource-strapped, and so they'll be the first to say that. They also there's a lot of whenever we're questioning them at hearings, et cetera, there's hesitation because the law requires right now there to be a local nonprofit or private partner putting up some of the money, and they have not yet been identified. But if that's the obstacle, then we need to find a way to waive that requirement or to move ahead on this. I haven't felt the urgency from them that I think my colleagues on the Great Lakes feel. And the other thing that I've said over and over again is, so if these plans are going to take years to implement, what's your emergency backup plan? What do you do when we hear that there's been Asian carp identified beyond that choke point of the Brandon lock and dam system? And that's something that we have to look at urgently.
And are you confident that we'll make any headway on this?
Well, we're applying constant pressure on this issue, and we have regular hearings among the Great Lakes Task Force in the Senate. The senators who sit on that certainly include the House members also, because I think we all feel that this is a truly urgent situation.
We're talking to Senator Tammy Baldwin right now. She's a Democrat representing Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate. Senator Baldwin, we're going to be talking about the tax plan a little bit later in our show today, but I wanted to get your reactions on the tax plan in its current iteration. What are your thoughts?
Well, I would say of both the House version and the Senate version, which do have differences, that both fail the test in my mind of making our tax system simpler and fairer for hardworking Wisconsin families, small businesses, and manufacturers. And the partisan fashion in which this legislation was put together means that great ideas haven't been brought to the table. For me, one of the most central priorities in tax reform legislation is to make sure that we reward hard work as much as the current tax system rewards wealth through lower tax rates. As I see it, and recent analysis of these two measures have indicated, that this is going to make it worse, that in some cases, wage earners will be getting the least in terms of benefits from this, and people who are wealthy and able to derive income from investments and, you know, get passive income will see lower rates. That's just not just. It's just not fair. So I have been fighting this measure and trying to get us to a place where we can work together to make sure that this is, in the end, what was originally promised, which is a significant middle class tax break and a reward for hard work, helping people get ahead again.
And you had your own plan that you presented in Wisconsin a few months ago with Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey. So I guess I have a bit of a two-parter question. One, did that gain any traction? And what was in that that made it different or made it stand out compared to the two plans that we are currently seeing?
Yes. So the Stronger Way Act is really about focusing in on the dignity of hard work and rewarding hard work through our tax code. And it really focuses on those who have been unable to get ahead despite working full-time. You know, some people are taxed into poverty. Others are working at low-wage jobs where even 40 hours a week can't bring themselves and their families out of the poverty or above the poverty level. So the Stronger Way Act combines an expanded transitional jobs program with and the earned income tax credit. It expands the earned income tax credit not only to families but also to individual workers, and it expands significantly the child tax credit, making it fully refundable and of greater benefit to working families, not only in Wisconsin, but across the country.
So it sounds like in talking to you, and I'm sure your Democratic colleagues would agree, that there's probably some room for a tax overhaul as it stands right now, maybe just the methodology or the way either Republicans or the Democrats are approaching it sounds like it's going to be a little bit different. Would you work with your Republican colleagues to find, I guess, some middle ground here? Because it sounds, not from you necessarily, but just in sort of the political conversations that have been happening, some finger pointing. So is that something that you would be willing to work on?
Absolutely. So here's the frustration that they chose in the Senate to use a process called budget reconciliation, which requires only a simple majority vote in the Senate. Now, that's the way the House works, but the Senate traditionally requires 60 votes to pass major legislation, and that mandates that the parties work together. And I think that we get better work products when we all get together and compromise, but do the work of the hardworking constituents who sent us to Washington to get the job done. That has not happened in this case, and it's so discouraging to be at a point this far along in the debate, rushing it through with very little time for comprehensive analysis by respected nonpartisan economists, et cetera. And then we find that it's not a middle-class tax cut. It's not a job creation bill. It's, in fact, a pretty big giveaway to the big corporations and the wealthiest few.
Well, Senator Baldwin, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Senator Tammy Baldwin was with us today to talk about Asian carp in the Great Lakes, as well as the congressional tax plans.
Coming up, in an era of endless screen time and high-tech answers to everything, some people are returning to pen and paper games like Dungeons and Dragons. Stay with us here on Central Time.
If you've watched the Netflix series Stranger Things, the young protagonists are playing Dungeons and Dragons. The show is set in the 80s, and the choice of game seems fittingly retro. Let's take a listen.
Mom, we're in the middle of a campaign.
You mean the end? 15 after.
No! Oh, my God. Oh,
freaking
idiot.
Mom, wait. 20 more minutes.
School night, Michael.
I just put Holly to bed. You can finish next weekend.
But then I ruined the flow.
Michael.
I'm serious, Mom. The campaign took 2 weeks to plan. How was I supposed to know it was going to take 10 hours?
You've been playing for 10 hours?
But a show set in 2017 could just as easily feature a group of friends playing D&D and getting lost in a world of heroes, fantasy, and adventure.
Nima Jaromi works on the editorial staff of The New Yorker, where he writes about the intersection of culture, philosophy, and politics, and he recently wrote about the somewhat unexpected resurgence of people playing D&D. Nima, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I have to say I feel both humble and intimidated to be speaking on Wisconsin public radio.
Oh, we're really easygoing here in Wisconsin. Nothing to worry about.
You're in Gygax country.
That's
basically true.
We are in large part the origin, the birthplace of Dungeons and Dragons. So for people who haven't played it, Nima, and haven't watched Stranger Things, can you give us a D&D 101? How does it work as a game?
So I think the first thing to say is that it is not a card game. A lot of people mix it up with Magic the Gathering.
Sure.
But it is basically there's players usually between 3 and 6 and a dungeon master who's sort of describing what happens, saying, you know, you're walking in a forest, or you wake up in bed, or you're all in a tavern drinking, and then asks the players what they like to do, and then they sort of describe it aloud. And if they want to try and trick somebody or intimidate somebody or fight them, swing a sword or a club, it's in a fantasy setting. They have to roll a 20-sided die, and getting a higher number means that you might be more successful in doing what you try to do. And then the dungeon master will reveal the consequences, and over hours you start to build out a story that you've kind of all created collectively, and it's mainly happening in your own heads.
Now, this got big in the 70s and into the 80s. I played it back then, And as you look at entertainment nowadays, you know, we've got computers and gadgets. We can play games kind of like this. We have so many electronic media. It might seem like this is something that would fall by the wayside. But you write, no, in many ways, it's had a revival, if anything.
Right. I mean, and I think that a big part of that revival is just people feeling that you don't need to take every piece of technology and exploit it and make it as naturalistic and all-consuming as you possibly can. Even in video games, there are sort of these lighter touch games, clicker games, and things like that that people are really engaged with. And I think that part of that is just sort of that they let you, there's a pleasure in kind of straining your imagination. You know, people still read poetry and go to plays when you could be sitting with a virtual reality headset on your head all the time. And I think that, you know, that every kind of level of technology in terms of gaming is its own aesthetic in a way.
And you profiled some people who play and who even started up almost businesses around this, hosting games. And as they delved more into it, it seemed like there's a real hunger for doing this activity that harnessed both creativity and sort of that sociability, bringing people together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I talked to the clinical psychologist, John Freeman, who runs a gaming store now. You know, he was mainly doing other kinds of board games until people started to get really interested in Dungeons & Dragons. And now there's been this cultural moment along this zeitgeist that has many causes that I think he and a lot of other gaming stores and various businesses have been able to capitalize on. It's really, it's a great phenomenon. I mean, I think, you know, there's a way in which everything old is new again, there's lots of different reasons that I think have to do with our particular moment for why it's so popular today.
I think the part of the story is probably people like me who played in our teens now have money to go out and buy the games again, or new versions or old versions, and nostalgia, though it is a lot easier to get a group of 15-year-olds together than a group of 40-somethings together to do something on a regular basis.
Right. I mean, that clip you were playing where they're talking about playing for 10 hours, I run a game like we meet every week or every other week, and we all sort of wish, you know, we're going through one of the published campaigns and we're looking at finishing it about a year, whereas if you're, you know, a 14-year-old kid and you have the whole summer, you can play 10 hours every day as long as, you know, your mom or dad doesn't stop you and you can get through a lot more story. It's great, and then I think the longevity of the game has brought a lot of people from different generations together to at least talk about the game, if not even play together.
And you write that it's being used sometimes therapeutically, helping kids express themselves, talk about trauma, difficulties in their life, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and it's interesting, and it's not, I mentioned just in general being able to talk to kids who are having a difficult time. It's a great therapeutic device. It also is good for kids with autism because, you know, sometimes that structure of a world where you can, where there are options and that are more sort of, that can be more clearly defined if you want them to be, makes it easier to talk about sort of psychological and emotional issues, but it can work for, you know, I spoke to a rancher in Montana who is sort of troubled by all the news and especially so much of what's happened politically in the last year and a half, and he's at work trying to build a really elaborate campaign using Dungeons & Dragons as a way to kind of unspool his thoughts about the present moment. And I think that, you know, if you can fit things almost allegorically into these categories, it can be helpful. It makes them a little bit more sort of bite-sized and limited and easier to confront.
And I love you had an anecdote about people talking about a session they were playing and no phones allowed. And in the middle of it, somebody pulled out a phone and saw the latest political headline and started to say it out loud. And people were like, no, not here, not now.
Yeah, because I mean, I think that, well, for one thing, it's the game for people who haven't played it can be somewhat intimidating because you have to think on your feet. You know, it's not like responding to an email or a tweet where, you know, you can sit there and compose it and delete it and draft it. It's real time. You have to talk. And that only becomes really, truly engaging when people are focused just on the game. And, you know, I mean, my players will sometimes look at their phones, and it's not like I'm chiding them or anything, but I think the ideal form of the game takes place in real time when people are talking to each other and can look each other in the eye, see each other's emotions, that kind of thing.
Well, an amazing thing, as a gaming person myself, board games and role-playing when I can, the internet didn't kill this. It made it more available. Now you can buy all the stuff on PDF and look up that rule you don't understand online. In some ways, the internet has made the non-internet stuff easier to get into.
Well, yeah, and absolutely. And people, of course, a huge number of people play online on various platforms, the platforms that sort of even maintain the rules so you don't have to think about them as much. But I think what's interesting is that even when people are using these digital tools, they're still doing something lower-fi and lower-tech than playing a more advanced game like Shadows of Mordor or something like that, which is based on The Lord of the Rings, which, you know, would have all these graphics and things. There's still that work your imagination has to do.
I'll jump in. We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Nima Jaromi. He's on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. He recently wrote about why people are returning, maybe in greater numbers now, to non-computer games like Dungeons & Dragons.
Coming up, we'll find out how Republican tax proposals would affect lower and middle-income Americans. I'm J. Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. House Republicans and Senate Republicans have each passed their own version of a tax overhaul bill known as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It's not a done deal yet. There are differences between the two plans, and lawmakers are trying to work those out this week.
Republicans say the plan has big benefits for business and job growth and sizable tax savings for middle-income Americans. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan when the House of Representatives unveiled their tax plan.
This plan is for the middle-class families in this country who deserve a break. It is for the families who are out there living paycheck to paycheck who just keep getting squeezed. You know, about half the country today is living paycheck to paycheck, and a lot more people are about a paycheck away from living paycheck to paycheck in this country, and this is going to help give people relief.
Our next guest says to figure out who the tax overhaul really helps, we have to look at how the $1.4 trillion revenue cuts will be paid for and who future spending cuts might affect.
William Gale is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He is the co-author of a new report, Winners and Losers After Paying for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And a key point you make in this report is don't just look at the $1.4 trillion in tax cuts and see who that affects. You say one way or another, we're going to pay for that and we have to figure out who that's going to impact. Do I have that right?
That's right. Tax cuts are only half of a policy. They're the fun part of the policy, but they have to be paid for. And the main message of our paper is that if you look at the ways that Republican leaders in Congress are talking about paying for the tax cuts, it's going to end up making most households, and in particular almost all low-income households, worse off rather than better off.
And before we dig into the details there, there's a one-page statement from the Treasury Department this week says these tax cuts will pay for themselves and eventually will come out ahead thanks to additional economic activity generated by the cuts plus some unspecified future regulatory and other reforms. So by that one sheet from the Treasury Department, we don't need to worry about how to pay for it.
Well, the Treasury one-page memo is I can't be dismissive enough of it. It basically, what Treasury did was take the incredibly optimistic growth assumptions that the administration is using and then looked at the revenue implications of that. And it's sort of a garbage in, garbage out analysis. What Treasury didn't do was analyze the growth effects of the tax bills. What they did was take the administration's assumption about growth and run it through their models. But you know, it's as equivalent to simply assuming a really good outcome and then saying, look, we get a really good outcome. I don't think the Treasury analysis is worth the piece of paper that it's written on.
Now, before we look into kind of the part two here, how do we cut spending if we do this tax plan in order to pay for it? Looking at just the tax changes themselves, before we get to those possible future spending cuts or other tax increases, how are those distributed across the income scale?
The good news is they're distributed fairly widely. The bad news is that they are definitely tilted toward the highest income taxpayers. So, for example, households in the bottom 20% of the income distribution will get, on average, a $60 tax cut, so a little over a dollar a week. Households in the top 1% will get about $37,000. On an annual basis. If you look at what happens to after-tax income, the distribution becomes more unequal if the bills were to pass. And so a lot of people do get some tax cuts. There's no question about that. But in terms of where the money is, it's going to high income and very high income households.
And then people have pointed to the what happens after 10 years question. A lot of the individual tax cuts are set to expire because that they needed to do that to get it in under a certain revenue loss ceiling, I guess. Is that right?
Right. That's a really good point. What I said before was for the tax cuts while they exist, but almost all of the individual tax cuts disappear in the Senate bill, although the corporate tax cuts are permanent.
Bill Gale is with us from the Brookings Institution. We're looking at his new report on winners and losers in the tax plans coming out of the House and Senate. And now let's get to the how do we pay for this, about $1.4-ish trillion in revenue loss in the form of these tax cuts. What kind of things, when you look at what Republicans have said about that, do you see getting cut in the next few years?
Well, Paul Ryan has said that they want to go after Medicare, Social Security, entitlements, and so on. And if you look at who benefits from those things, it's predominantly low and middle-income households. A vast proportion of seniors depend on Social Security for, you know, more than two-thirds or more than 90% of their income. Medicare, Medicaid go to predominantly low-income households. And what the Republican leaders have been very clear, what they want to do is cut entitlements.
And they've talked about phasing that in. So people currently relying on, say, Social Security, seniors on any of these programs, they might not face cuts. It's adjusting cuts for younger people. They'll have less to look forward to in the future. Is that how that would probably happen if it came through?
That's one possibility. The proposals that have been put forth in the past for Social Security tend to exempt people who are 55 and older from the adjustments. The Medicare proposals that have been put forth in the past tend to have impact more quickly.
So when you start to account for that, and I know you have to kind of make some educated guesses since there's not an exact plan on the table, but when you start to account for those kind of cuts, how does the distribution of tax cut benefits start to look, again, for lower and middle income Americans?
Right. So what we did was look at three different ways of financing the tax cuts. One was assuming each household paid the same amount in dollars. One is assuming that each household paid the same share of their income, and one is assuming that everyone got the same percentage increase in their income tax. I think the most realistic option, given the fact that Ryan and other Republican leaders have talked about cutting entitlements, the most realistic option is that everyone pays the same amount. And if you do that, then about 70% of the households in the country end up being worse off than they would have been if we had not enacted the tax cut and not pursued the financing option. So almost 100% of households in the bottom 40% of the income distribution, about 71% of households in the middle of the income distribution are worse off.
And how about at the top of the scale?
The top of the scale, it's 20%, 10%, depending on the exact income level. So because of the design of the tax bill is so uneven, you do get some people who end up losing at the top. But predominantly, this is, that household in the bottom quintile that would have got $60 in tax cuts ends up paying $1,200 more in terms of the financing costs. So it's a bad deal. It's a bad trade-off for most households, and in particular for low- and middle-income households.
I should throw another option out there, and that's do nothing. Cut the taxes, cut the revenue by $1.4 trillion, and let it add to the deficit. What would the effect there be?
Right. Well, at some point, we need to pay for the tax cuts. If it adds to the debt, that postpones the day of reckoning. It doesn't eliminate the need to finance tax cuts. But if it adds to the debt, it'll draw investment away from more productive uses and slow the rate of growth, which is one of several reasons why the tax package, looking at it standalone, is not going to be favorable for economic expansion.
William Gale is with us from the Brookings Institution, looking at winners and losers in the Republican tax overhaul plans.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the impact these changes could have on the tax system? What do you think of the Republican tax plans that are currently being floated around? And should they be passed or not? And what changes would you like to see? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. William Gale is with us from the Brookings Institution. He's with us to break down the winners and the losers in the Republican tax overhaul plan.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your comments. What do you think of what you have seen so far from the House and Senate tax overhaul plans? There's a lot going on there. What concerns do you have? What hopes do you have for a change in the U.S. tax system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. Thank you for covering this subject. This is probably the most important subject you guys could talk about today. And this is really the reason why the Republican Party exists, so that wealthy campaign contributors can get a tax cut so they don't have to pay as much money to the federal government. And that's the reason why the Koch brothers wanted entitlement reform, which is just another name for cutting Medicare and cutting Social Security so that the rich campaign contributors don't pay more money. The thing that really is disappointing to me, though, is that the Democrats don't have a strong message that they can say that really this is class warfare. This is the rich trying to take control of the federal government and pillage the federal government for their benefit. So I was just really disappointed that the Democrats even entertained the idea of a bipartisan tax cut bill here when it's very clear what the Republicans' intentions were all along. And the Democrats have to have a strong message against it.
Peter, thanks for the call. Bill, your thoughts on the politics Peter is pointing to there.
The Democrats had an interesting strategy on, or an interesting set of guidelines that they produced several months ago. They wanted it to be revenue neutral. They didn't want tax increases for the middle class. They didn't want tax cuts for the rich. And one could have designed a tax reform package around that. They did not do that. And I don't think that there was any real chance for a bipartisan deal here. I think with the Republicans controlling both houses and of Congress and the White House, I think they wanted to do their thing. But I agree that the reform discussion has been largely about largely motivated by politics, as opposed to what they could have done if they had designed a more economically sound package.
Peter, thanks for that call. Bill, let me throw this wrinkle at you as we talk about how this affects lower and middle income Americans. As you're saying, when you weigh the tax cuts they'd get versus spending cuts that would affect them, lower and middle class Americans, most of them would be worse off. The Republican argument, I think, would be, hey, we're lowering corporate taxes. We're making it easier for companies to do business in the United States. There will be more jobs for those lower and middle income Americans and hopefully better pay. Is that something that you see maybe working out that way?
Those are definitely the Republican talking points. I don't think that they hold water. A number of analyses have suggested that the growth effects would not be that big. For a number of reasons, just tick off a few. The increase in the deficit would hamper growth. The elimination of the state and local income tax deduction will raise marginal tax rates. Their proposals to cut back on education and research and development will not help. They're going to make it harder for states to finance education and infrastructure, which will also hurt growth. And they've got a variety of international provisions that actually encourage firms to shift money and jobs overseas. So, the main talking point for growth is that they'll give accelerated deductions for investment and they'll lower the corporate tax. But most analyses suggest that those gains are outweighed by the other things that I talked about. So if they want to design a package for growth, they could have done a lot better. This comes back to the first caller's question, the role of politics in this. Growth is certainly the talking point they're using, but this is not a tax cut that's well designed to stimulate growth.
Let's go back to our callers now. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, folks, and thanks for taking my question tonight. It's a general one. I've been following this, you know, from a distance, and it seems like it's still evolving, you know, in the conference committee between the House and the Senate. But I'm wondering what you folks know at this time, at this point, about the deductions, the itemized deductions that those of us who are, you know, middle class folks have enjoyed in the past, the state and local income tax deduction, the mortgage interest deduction, you know, that sort of thing.
Well,
you know,
thanks. Great questions. Bill, what do we know about changes to deductions that affect people in the middle class range?
I think they're going to get smaller. State and local tax deduction is you know, on the chopping block. The mortgage interest deduction is going to be curtailed directly in the amount that can be deducted, but also the increase in the standard deduction is going to make it less attractive to itemize in the first place. Another itemized deduction that hasn't been talked about all that much is that for high medical expenses. The House bill would eliminate that. The Senate bill would actually expand it and make it more generous. And it'll be interesting to see what they do in conference on this.
Well, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're looking at the impact of Republican tax overhaul plans. There's a separate plan in the Senate and the House. They're working to get those together. Our guest co-wrote a report on winners and losers in that plan. Back to your calls now. Chris is on the line in Columbus. Chris, hi.
Hey, great topic as usual.
Thanks.
And I got to ask your guest, my opinion is that all government programs should be paid for, including by the people who are beneficiaries of them. So I am a proponent of a flat tax, no deductions. Everybody pays, 5% of your income, whether it's earned income or dividends and returns. What's your guest's opinion on that?
Flat tax, Bill.
It's a great question. A couple of thoughts. One is that the rate would have to be much higher than 5%. The second is, I don't know if it's a politically stable solution. People tend to say, "Oh, we go to flat tax. You send all the lobbyists home." No, you don't do that. The lobbyists just start over the same game at a new starting point. And it would also be quite regressive relative to the system we have now. I understand the point that there are some programs where you should have the beneficiaries pay, but there's also, in my view at least, there's also a role for government in redistributing income, and that involves having, in some cases, people who are not beneficiaries paying for the benefits that someone else gets.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We'll go now to Nate on the line in Prairie du Sac. Nate, hi.
Thanks for taking the call. I'd like to have the speaker comment on a thing that I have been puzzling. Republicans have tended to say the holy grail of economics is the market, the market, the market, the market. However, I do not understand terms of this tax legislation of trying to give more and more breaks to wealthier and wealthier people, how that really facilitates the market. Because if there isn't a demand for goods and services, I do not see how putting more hands in the pockets of more money in the pockets of wealthy people who can just put it in investments that don't require the market to act.
Nate, I gotcha. So that, and this is an argument, is it better to have more money in the hands of more people at lower income levels who are more likely to spend it, or top down, as Nate was describing this tax overhaul?
We've had almost 40 years now of trickle-down economics thrown at us. It hasn't worked in the U.S. It didn't work in Kansas. It hasn't worked across other countries. So it comes back to the first caller who asked about the politics of the situation, which I think is dead on. There are ways, I think, to make the economy grow better than sharing benefits on the wealthiest households.
And briefly, Bill, this bill aside, is our tax system due for an overhaul? We don't need to get into the specifics of what it could be, but do we need to make some tweaks?
There's huge room for improvement in the tax system, yes.
We'll leave it there for now. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's William Gale. He's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. We've been talking about a report he co-authored on winners and losers in the tax overhaul plans currently before the U.S. Senate and U.S. House. You can still share your thoughts, by the way, on that. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you think over there. Or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR.